You've heard of the Greater Israel Project. You think it's something Israel's still working toward, but you're wrong. The Greater Israel Project is already here. It exists by proxy. What Israel seeks now is far more ambitious. A global empire. Not through physical occupation, but through proxy power, surveillance, and artificial intelligence. This is an eschatological endgame. A Jewish empire ruled by the chosen people. Born through chaos, justified with prophecy, enforced by data, empowered by an artificial Messiah that sees, predicts, and governs human behavior with godlike authority. To some, it's redemption, the long-awaited promise of heaven brought down to earth by human hands. But to others, it's the Antichrist, a dystopian hellscape, a blasphemous kingdom where science becomes sorcery, machines become oracles, and an all-seeing godlike intelligence rules mankind from temples of data, demanding submission, not through faith, but through surveillance. Call it Pax Judaica, or call it the future. Either way, it doesn't need your consent, only your submission. The Pax Romana, or Roman peace, was a long period of relative stability enforced not by harmony, but by dominance. It was peace through power, maintained by military supremacy, centralized authority, and the suppression of rebellion, not the absence of violence. Scholars later used the term Pax to describe similar eras. Pax Britannica, for example, followed Britain's victory over Napoleon and rested on naval dominance and global trade control. And Pax Americana emerged after World War II, shaped by aircraft carriers, missile cruisers, and the petrodollar system. In every case, Pax did not mean an end to conflict. Wars and uprisings continued. What changed was the hierarchy. Authority was settled, and those seeking power or protection orbited themselves around this new political gravity at the center of a new world order. Crucially, Pax periods are never declared in real time. They are recognized in hindsight. Once resistance becomes marginal and competitors accept that victory is no longer possible. Today, some argue a new order is forming, one they call Pax Judaica, an era in which Israel's rivals have been neutralized and its influence consolidated, not only through military outcomes, but through political leverage, lobbying power, blackmail, intelligence dominance, and advanced surveillance. At first glance, this idea seems implausible. Israel is small. It lacks strategic depth. It depends heavily on Western military, economic, and diplomatic support, and exists within the framework of the American Empire. So how could it possibly function as a global empire, exerting influence far beyond its borders? The answer requires us to rethink what power looks like in the information age. When most people hear the word empire, they imagine vast armies occupying territory, overseas bases spanning continents, massive navies patrolling the globe, and aircraft carriers parked off foreign coasts. In short, hard power. Israel does not fit that traditional image. Yet Israel is a formidable military force. It possesses the most powerful military in the Middle East, and, according to senior analysts at the Institute for the Study of War, fields the best air force in the world on a pilot-for-pilot basis. It operates advanced naval assets, including nuclear-capable submarines, maintains at least 150 nuclear warheads, making it one of only 9 nuclear-armed states, and fields the densest and most sophisticated air defense network on the planet, rendering it more militarily capable than most states, including many in Western Europe. What Israel lacks is not capability, but scale. It does not have the population, industrial base, resources, or global logistics footprint of traditional empires like the United States, Russia, or China. It does not field aircraft carriers or manufacture the volume of hardware and weaponry required to sustain global conventional dominance on its own. But what if that no longer mattered? What if influence no longer required matching great powers ship for ship or base for base? What if control came not from possessing a global force, but from directing one? What if the key was not actually becoming an empire, but steering one that already exists? Israel's power derives less from what it controls within its borders than from the leverage it exercises beyond them through institutions, alliances, intelligence networks, technology, finance, lobbying, blackmail, and propaganda in other countries. In short, Pax Judaica describes an empire made possible by proxy, sustained gained leverage over existing powers rather than direct occupation. The United States remains the most powerful imperial structure on Earth, militarily, financially, and institutionally. But power does not necessarily belong to whoever owns the machine, it belongs to whoever steers it. Over the decades, Israel Zionist networks in the United States learned how to operate inside the institutions where American interests are interpreted and decisions are made. As a result, Israel does not need to own or command the aircraft carrier if it can shape the conversation that determines where it sails. Therefore, Pax Judaica is not about replacing or equaling American power, but hijacking it, leveraging U.S. resources to advance Israel's own interests and goals. Yet for many, Pax Judaica still sounds implausible, and I think it's because people still don't grasp the extent to which Israel has gained leverage over the American empire. Beneath all the arguments, what this comes down to is one question. Does the dog wag the tail, or does the tail wag the dog? Critics of the claim that Israel now steers U.S. power usually argue that the American empire is fragmented, with countless factions competing for influence driven by money, inertia, or careerism, and that pro-Israel networks are merely one player among many. This argument isn't wrong. It just underestimates Zionism. The American empire is not a single actor. It is a sprawling system of institutions where American interests are interpreted and executed by individual people. Most participants inside that system are not playing a long game. They are individuals pursuing funding, prestige, or survival. They rotate in and out. They manage decline. They have momentum, but no destination or long-term goal outside of their own personal interests. Zionism is different. What distinguishes Israel First loyalists is not raw power, but clarity and dedication of mission. Whether secular or religious, Zionists are a collective operating with a coherent long-term objective, assisting one another to attain position in order to achieve that objective. In slow, bloated bureaucracies, the faction that knows exactly what it wants will outperform those that do not. The second argument holds that the United States has always been imperial, long before its relationship with Israel, and that Israel functions merely as a regional asset, a junior partner doing America's dirty work rather than shaping policy. Supporters of this view often cite Joe Biden's remark that if there were not an Israel, we'd have to invent one, or former Secretary of State Alexander Haig's description of Israel as America's largest aircraft carrier that cannot be sunk. In this framework, Israel is a strategic tool, not an independent driver of power. These claims are not false. They're just no longer true. They reflect a Cold War era that no longer exists. The collapse of the Soviet Union removed a peer competitor in the region that backed the pan-Arab movements opposed to Western imperialism. Subsequent wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria destroyed rival states and turned the rest of the region into a network of collaborators. In this environment, the United States no longer depends on a single indispensable enforcer to project power. It has no shortage of partners willing to offer money, diplomatic alignment, intelligence cooperation, basing access and territory to maintain U.S. dominance. In that context, Israel is no longer uniquely necessary as an unsinkable aircraft carrier, which raises the real question. If the United States no longer needs Israel to project power in the region, why does it insist on continuing to empower Israel over all others? Why tolerate behavior that generates instability, backlash, and regional chaos when there are alternative partners willing to serve U.S. interests and pay for the privilege? This is why the old model breaks down, and the argument shifts from hard power to institutional leverage. On paper, the United States holds enormous leverage over Israel. In theory, this should allow Washington to compel Israeli behavior. In practice, however, across multiple administrations, whether they're Democratic or Republican, it has not been able to restrain or compel Israeli behavior. And it's not because the leverage doesn't exist. It's because the leverage is neutralized from within. This contrast is revealing. In the early 1990s, Israel required U.S. guarantees for a $10 billion loan to absorb Russian immigrants after the Soviet Union collapse. President George H.W. Bush was interested in negotiating a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians at the time. So President H.W. Bush wanted a guarantee that Israel was not going to use the money that the U.S. was going to help them obtain to expand settlements in the West Bank. So he used his leverage over Israel, drew a hard line, and forced compliance. And it worked Israel caved, but it was the last time they would ever do so. Fast forward 20 years, and Benjamin Netanyahu standing in front of Congress urging the United States to sabotage its own president and the Iran nuclear agreement in order to satisfy Israel's interests, which ended up happening within just a few years. A decade later, despite Israel's full dependence on American weapons and cover, both Joe Biden and Donald Trump gave it everything it needed to carry out the genocide in Gaza and go to war with Iran. Aircraft carriers were deployed, missile defenses were activated, tens of billions of dollars were spent, all at enormous cost to America's global standing and domestic political support. By any rational measure, this ran against America's interests. Yet it continued. Israel was still dependent on the United States, arguably more than ever. So how did the US go from President Bush demanding Israel cave to his demands to presidents bending over and giving Israel everything it wants? The answer is simple. What changed was Israel's leverage over America's leverage. You see, administrations rotate, presidents come and go, but Zionist networks with their long-term objectives remain embedded, permanent, shaping narratives and incentives from inside the system. To quote Benjamin Netanyahu from a private conversation recorded over 30 years ago, America is a thing that is easily moved. So the force still moves, the weapons remain American, the sanctions remain American, the flag is still American, but the direction is not. This is what I mean by proxy rule. Not by Israel holding the sword of empire, but by dictating where it swings. And that is why Pax Judaica is invisible to those still expecting to see the Jewish empire resemble something like Rome, Britain, or the United States in its traditional form. To put this in pop culture terms, you're searching for the female titan. What you need to be looking for is Annie. Under Pax Judaica, the empire will still appear American. Power will still seem to flow from Washington. But the real axis of approval, denial, and permission will run through Jerusalem. And by the time history names it in hindsight, it will already be complete. By now, the pattern should be visible. Israel's leverage over US policy isn't always easy to articulate, but it is something that I'm sure you feel, because many Americans feel it. That unspoken tension is why a fierce debate now rages on the right between America first and Israel first. But let's examine a few cases to further demonstrate the point. Because once you understand how power currently operates in the modern world, you begin to see who must be courted, who must be appeased, and in what order. After the fall of Bashar al-Assad, Syria wanted sanctions relief, so it pursued meetings with pro-Israel donors, organizations, and advocacy groups. Syria got what it wanted, and the US lifted sanctions. The UAE wanted advanced weapons and clearance to pursue its interests aggressively in East Africa, so it normalized with the Zionists. The US approved the weapon sales and the UAE's plans. UAE got what it wanted. Javier Milei wanted support for his presidency in Argentina, so he went to Jerusalem and touched the wall. Just a few days before he was to be re-elected, the US bailed him out and helped him win. He got what he wanted. And Maria Corina Machado pledged to align her government closely with Israel should she take power in Caracas. The US is now currently at war with Venezuela in an attempt to put her in power. Now let's pose a question that we all know the answer to. If Syria, the UAE, Javier Milei, or Maria Machado offered to do whatever the US asked but opposed Israel, would they have gotten what they wanted? We all know the answer to that question. So the implication then is clear. Access to Washington runs through the Zionists. These are not isolated or unique gestures. They are signals of who truly holds power. In any PAC system, elites instinctively learn where authority ultimately rests. They learn which doors open others and which remain locked, no matter how loudly you knock. This is how gatekeeping works. Alignment is rewarded, non-alignment is punished. Despite the genocide in Gaza, you find state actors and elites from all around the world seeking Israel's favor. Meanwhile, Russia is treated as a toxic actor for its invasion of Ukraine, despite being 100 times more powerful than Israel in terms of hard power. These states and actors are positioning themselves within a system they believe will endure, orbiting the political gravity of Pax Judaica. Now the question becomes, how does this system cement itself? In the digital age, the answer is surveillance. In a world growing more chaotic and unstable by the year, power no longer comes from force alone. It comes from visibility. Governments are shifting from punishing dissent after it occurs to anticipating and neutralizing it before it even forms. This is where data, AI, and surveillance becomes decisive. Once separate systems like banking, taxes, travel, biometrics, social media, communications are now now being merged into unified profiles that track not only who people are, but how much money they have, how they behave, what they believe in, and what they are likely to do next. This convergence is accelerating. At the same time, artificial intelligence is automating entire sectors of labor, concentrating wealth upward at a rate we've never seen before, and hollowing out one of the primary sources of meaning and structure in modern life, work. This creates a problem that no empire has ever faced before. How do you govern populations that are no longer economically necessary, but remain politically present? One answer is dependency. In exchange for taking all of the jobs and all of the wealth, AI companies will offer consistent stimulus checks, otherwise known as universal basic income. OpenAI, for example, created WorldCoin, a cryptocurrency to share wealth with the average pleb. To obtain this WorldCoin, you must first scan your iris so your profile can be reviewed. This UBI is framed as fair exchange for taking all of the world's wealth and labor. In reality, however, it is a shackle, a chain, forced dependence that crushes human individual autonomy. Systems like universal basic income from AI companies that will distribute resources at scale require monitoring, eligibility, and enforcement. So in short, your survival as a person that can no longer earn money in a world where AI has taken all the jobs will be conditional on whether or not you behave and obey the system. So if you behave, scan your iris and you'll get your stimulus check. Criticize the government or express a dissenting opinion, and when you scan your iris, you'll be denied the resources you need to live. Even if you have money or credits saved up, you will not be able to spend it if your identity has been flagged for non-compliance. You won't be able to drive, fly, buy food, exercise, get healthcare, or travel without total submission to the system. This system is being built. That is why surveillance will be crucial. And as we mentioned earlier, historically, personal data was compartmentalized. Today, those walls are quickly collapsing, and private technology firms are parking themselves between governments and populations, integrating data at scale and centralizing surveillance infrastructure across borders. All of your data is being packaged into a neat little profile so the elite who hoard all the wealth can determine whether or not you're being a good little goy. Boy. This is where leverage is going to emerge. And once you start asking who controls that leverage, Pax Judaica will start to make sense. Now let's talk about how artificial intelligence and surveillance involves Israel. What does OpenAI, WorldCoin, Silicon Valley, and all this technological innovation have to do with Pax Judaica? Quite a lot, actually. For example, Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, traveled to Israel to meet with Israeli President Isaac Herzog, where he openly discussed investing in Israel and recruiting from its talent pool. This wasn't symbolic diplomacy. It was strategic alignment. Israel is being positioned not merely as a consumer of AI, but as a development hub for the most powerful technologies shaping the future of governance, surveillance, and control. More importantly, OpenAI's co-founder, Ilya Sutskever, is Israeli. He has since left OpenAI and founded a new company called Safe Superintelligence, explicitly aimed at building systems more powerful than artificial general intelligence. That company has offices in Tel Aviv. This matters because whoever builds the next generation of AI systems, systems capable of prediction, behavioral modeling, and decision-making at scale, gains leverage, not just over markets, but over states. And by having offices in Tel Aviv, these Zionists, whether they are Israeli citizens or Zionist Jewish Americans, position very sensitive data and technology in a place that is easily accessible for the Israelis to steal, which I'll elaborate on just a little bit later in this video. Then there's Palantir. Alex Karp, Palantir's co-founder and CEO, is an openly pro-Israel Zionist who has repeatedly framed his company's work in civilizational and moral terms. Palantir has secured contracts with governments all around the world, providing AI-driven surveillance, predictive policing, and behavioral analysis tools. Palantir's technology has been directly linked to kill chains, automated systems that integrate surveillance, targeting, and execution. In Gaza, these kinds of AI systems have already been used and were exposed for enabling strikes that killed up to 100 innocent civilians for the suspected presence of a single Hamas operative. Karp himself has gone viral multiple times for what can only be described as unhinged messianic rhetoric, openly embracing the role of technologist as deity, speaking about power, destiny, and the the moral right to decide who lives and who dies through systems he helped build. This is not speculative fiction. It is already operational. But it goes even deeper. In late July, the U.S. cybersecurity giant Palo Alto Networks, founded by former Israeli intelligence officer Nir Zuk of Unit 8200, paid $25 billion to acquire another Israeli cybersecurity firm, CyberArk, which was also founded by a former Israeli intelligence officer, Uri Mokadi. In August, DropSite News reported that Google paid $32 billion to acquire another Israeli company called Wiz, which is a cybersecurity company co-founded by four Israeli intelligence officers. These companies handle their clients' customer data. If you are a bank and you are using Palo Alto Networks, the data about all your customers and their transactions are passing through servers that are controlled by spies or former spies. Palo Alto Networks, CyberArk, and Wiz now sit at the center of Western cloud security, identity management, and server infrastructure, the very backbone of modern digital society. And as of June of 2025, over 1,400 veterans of Israeli intelligence are working inside U.S. tech companies. Roughly 900 of them come directly from Unit 8200 alone. These are not junior employees. They occupy senior and mid-level engineering, security, and architecture roles across companies operating in the U.S., Europe, and Israel. Microsoft alone employs roughly 250 Unit 8200 veterans. Other major employers include NVIDIA, Meta, Google, Intel, and Apple. No other country enjoys this level of penetration into the American tech sector. We obsess over Chinese influence and technology. We warn endlessly about corporate espionage and foreign interference. Yet Israeli penetration is rarely discussed. Now the concern here is that Israeli intelligence officers are going to steal very sensitive data, technology, and information and pass it along to Israel, which they can then use for leverage to gain power over the U.S. and virtually everyone else. Why is that the concern? Well, it's because there's a history of it. Israel has repeatedly been identified by U.S. intelligence agencies as an aggressive intelligence actor targeting American institutions. The most infamous case is Jonathan Pollard, a U.S. intelligence analyst who stole massive quantities of classified military intelligence and passed it to Israel. Pollard, one of the greatest traitors, if not the greatest traitor in American history, was flown to Israel, granted citizenship, and welcomed personally by Benjamin Netanyahu. Upon landing, Pollard fell to his knees and kissed the ground. I think it's fair to say he wasn't America first. Despite Israel being formally recognized as an intelligence threat, American governments and corporations continue to grant Israeli intelligence-linked firms access to sensitive data through contracts, hiring pipelines, and acquisitions. This is how Israel gains leverage. Now let's put this all together. OpenAI, Palantir, cybersecurity monopolies, Unit 8200 pipelines, AI-driven surveillance, predictive control. A pattern emerges. Israel is not accidentally overrepresented in AI, data, cybersecurity, and intelligence. It is intentionally positioning itself at the choke points of the digital world, and in a world governed by data. Whoever sees everything decides everything. This is how and why surveillance is not a side issue of Pax Judaica. It's its foundation. Whoever designs and interprets these systems doesn't merely observe it, they shape it. They determine which behaviors are flagged and which people retain access. And Israel has positioned itself as structurally central to this architecture. You see, Palestine is one large cage for lab rats. Decades of Israeli military occupation produced expertise in signal intelligence, population monitoring, and behavioral prediction. That experience migrated into the private sector and became exportable infrastructure. In short, Israel's crimes against the Palestinians became a commercial product. As Western governments confront instability from migration to economic decline, they will increasingly rely on technologies that enable total surveillance. Sensitive data, predictive capacity, and analytical power will flow through Israeli-linked security ecosystems. So this is not about troops or territory. This is about reach. The ability to monitor populations at scale, predict intent, and intervene invisibly creates a form of dominance previous empires never possessed. Authority will become continuous, preemptive, and unseen. That is how Pax Judaica becomes inevitable. And what we're witnessing now are actually early flashes of this kind of control. We've all witnessed Zionist networks direct Western states to arrest, censor, and destroy lives in the name of protecting the Jewish empire. From ICE kidnapping kidnapping critics of Israel on the streets in broad daylight, to doctors having their medical license revoked over tweeting about Jewish supremacy, Zionism, and Israel's genocide in Gaza, to mass arrests of activists upholding international law, the pattern is clear. This level of control is unprecedented, but it's not exactly unexpected. Science fiction and religion have long warned of this kind of power taking form. These warnings, found in the eschatological traditions of the Abrahamic faiths, are relevant to the concept of Pax Judaica, because the Israeli state invokes Judaism itself, grounding its legitimacy in Jewish religious inheritance, and because Zionists openly invoke theology to justify their political power. Zionism has long argued that Jewish sovereignty over Palestine is divinely sanctioned, rooted in biblical promise rather than modern international law. That claim has been used to justify settlement expansion, ethnic cleansing, permanent domination, and even genocide, framed not as political choices, but as fulfillment of destiny. This is not merely propaganda aimed at manipulating religious zealots. It reflects genuine belief within certain Israeli religious and political circles. You see, there exists a well-documented current of religious Zionism that interprets modern Israeli power as a step towards messianic fulfillment. Within this framework, events like territorial expansion, permanent military dominance, and even the destruction of existing holy sites like Al-Aqsa are viewed not as tragedies, but as prerequisites. They believe these events will trigger the return of the Messiah, and they seek the return of the Messiah in order to satisfy their own prophecy, because the story of the Jewish faith is incomplete without the return of the Messiah. You see, these Jews don't just believe that they are God's chosen that get to live in the land of Palestine. They also believe that it is their destiny to rule over humanity.
The whole purpose of the War of Gog and Magog
is to change the entire hierarchy of who's in charge. Palestinians to be on top and in charge.
Because the light of Hashem comes through us.
To give us the power is to take with the power from the Ulus Island, from the nations of the world. Time for your Gaula is here. It's time for you to become the leader of the world. Hashem will be the one who gives us power, gives us strength. The Jewish people will be the leaders of the world.
All prophecy here. Yitzchak said, I made him your master. Whatever I will give you will be his. Better for you, you don't get a lot. Anyway, will belong to him. Whatever you're gonna have, the Jews will always control you. The Jews are in charge of the world. Science, financial, politics, behind the presidents. Even now, everybody knows that all the campaign of Donald Trump is his son-in-law, the Jew, Kash Kushner.
Not all Jews believe this, but a powerful block of Zionists do, and they believe they must hasten the return of the Messiah by advancing Israel's power on earth. One of the most influential figures in modern Jewish religious history was Menachem Mendel Schneerson, otherwise known as the Lubavitcher Rebbe of the Chabad movement. His teachings profoundly shaped messianic expectations within parts of the Zionist world. High-ranking Israeli politicians often sought his guidance, and his influence extended well beyond theology into statecraft. In the early 1990s, Schneerson told Netanyahu that he wasn't doing enough to hasten the return of the Messiah. This is a reminder that religious urgency has always existed alongside Israeli power. Now, it is critical to be precise here. Jews interpret their faith differently. There are Jews opposed to this because they believe that they must be passive and patient as they wait for the Messiah to return. But a powerful block of Zionist ideology does exist, one that fuses theology, state power, and historical destiny into a single narrative of ascendancy. That is why eschatology matters when discussing Pax Judaica. Because when a state defines itself as the Jewish state and claims land through divine inheritance, fields religious nationalist soldiers, and demands unconditional support from Western Christians on the basis of religious chosenness, religion ceases to be private belief and becomes political infrastructure. Now, with this eschatological context in mind, the convergence of artificial intelligence, surveillance, and economic dependency takes on a new meaning. In Christian eschatology, the false Messiah, or Antichrist, is described described as a ruler who establishes a system so total in its control that participation in society itself becomes conditional. The Book of Revelation describes the mark of the beast as a mechanism of exclusion. No one could buy or sell unless he had the mark. The phrase mark of the beast appears in Revelation 13 and is central to the prophecy regarding the end times. The passage states, "And the second beast required all people, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark. The name of the beast, or the number of its name." Many interpret this as a prophecy of a future literal mark required for participation in society's economic systems. Proponents suggest it could involve technology or a physical emblem placed on an individual's right hand or forehead. The structure is unmistakable. Economic survival becomes conditional with compliance to a centralized authority. Or in other words, if you want to buy something, you need to behave so that OpenAI can give you WorldCoin. Just an example. Modern technology makes such a system feasible for the first time in human history. A fully centralized AI, fed by surveillance, behavioral data, financial records, and predictive modeling, will determine who is permitted to work, transact, travel, or receive assistance. Participation would no longer be a right, but a privilege granted conditionally by those in power. Now, whether you read this as a literal prophecy, or allegory, or a warning, the pattern is clear. A system where survival depends on your submission, where convenience replaces freedom, and where power becomes godlike because it can see everything. Now, historically, every Pax, whether it was Pax Romana, Pax Britannica, or Pax Americana, every empire establishes a hierarchy and concentrates power. But what makes Pax Judaica distinct is not merely its reach, but its timing. Because it presents itself not just as another potential empire in history, but as the end of history itself.
But today the Jews rule this world by proxy. They get others to fight and die for them. They have now gained control of the most powerful countries. And they, this tiny community, have become a world power.
In a speech in 2003, you said, quote, "The Jews rule the world by proxy. They get others to fight and die for them." In 2012, you wrote you were glad to be labeled anti-Semitic and that sympathy with Jewish victims of the Holocaust was wasted and misplaced. Isn't it the case that your political legacy, your accomplishments, will forever be tainted until you apologize and withdraw such anti-Semitic remarks?
No, I believe I'm speaking the truth. You look at America, it is totally dedicated to supporting Israel even when Israel commits international crime. In fact, candidates for election need to inform the Jewish lobby that they are supporting
but
Israel.
Why are you conflating Israel with all Jews?
What I said was that the Jews are ruling the world by proxy.
That's an outrageous claim with no evidence.
Of course,
how can you say that Jews are ruling the world? That is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, is it not?
If you refuse to see evidence,
what is
then
your evidence?
I can help you.
What is your evidence for the fact that Jews are, quote, ruling the world?
Jews are not too many. There are not very many Jews in this world. By themselves, they cannot rule this world. But they can influence countries to do the work for them. And America is very much under Jewish influence. That is why it supports Israel, whether Israel is doing the right thing or not, whether it commits crimes or not. Israel does all kinds of horrible things.
What do you think? Are we already living under Pax Judaica, or are we watching it develop itself in real time? Is this order inevitable, or is it being overstated and exaggerated? Is artificial intelligence just another tool of power, or is it something darker? Something dystopian, something satanic. Are we already at the point of no return, or is there still time to break the Zionist leverage over American power? I want to hear your thoughts, so let me know in the comment section. Please do become a member. Thanks for watching, and as always, take care of yourselves.